you know, one of the truest signs of friendship is that someone will come back from a trip and actually show up to be on a panel with you. And another sign of friendship is that your friend stands there, holds up your book so the camera can see the book, and then actually urges people to go buy it. Thank you, Rob. I'm really happy that Tom is here, not only because we've been close for a long time, but because we've been close in no small part because Tom covered a period when we had an administration that really engaged in statecraft. When I was originally going to write this book, I was going to write a book just about negotiations. But as I watched the reality of our statecraft disappear from at least public visage, I decided that, in fact, I would do something on this theme. So what do I mean by statecraft? Let's play a little game. If in 2009 we had an administration that came in, and that administration was really expert in terms of how it wielded all of its diplomatic tools and instruments, it was expert in terms of how it used intelligence, it really knew how to use public information to shape and frame policies. It understood the essence of coercion. It knew how to use hard power, but it also knew how to use soft power. Would that be an administration that was good at statecraft? I mean, most people, when they hear the term, they think about the tools of the trade. So I just described a lot of the tools of the trade, the instrumentalities of the state that the state can use to pursue its interests and to protect its interests. Would that be a good example of an administration that knew how to use statecraft? What do you think?
Not necessarily.
Yes? No?
Maybe.
I'm making you a participant. You're shy. You don't know. Some people may think it's a trick question. No, actually, it's a rhetorical question. It's rhetorical from the standpoint that that would be an incomplete use of statecraft. It wouldn't be a good example of statecraft being conducted well. Because what happens if all those instruments are being used very well, but in the service of objectives that make no sense, in the service of purposes that are disconnected from reality? Let's flip it. Let's assume we have an administration that really gets what our role in the world ought to be, that really understands and defines what our purposes are very well, that specifies objectives that make sense, but is not very good in terms of how it implements. It's not very good in terms of how it uses all the instruments at its disposal, and it isn't very good in terms of mirroring those means to its objectives. That would also be a bad example of statecraft. So we need an administration that both can define what our role in the world ought to be, but also one that knows how to use the instruments. If you don't marry objectives and means, by definition, you're going to have bad statecraft. You want to take a look at examples of bad statecraft? How about Iraq? How about Iraq as a poster child? Did we marry objectives and means in Iraq? Obviously, no. I mean, think about it just at one level, a simple level. If Iraq had actually had weapons of mass destruction, we didn't put enough force in there either to take control of all the sites of weapons of mass destruction or to prevent it from being, those weapons of mass destruction, from being smuggled out or ferreted out of Iraq. We didn't have the forces either to deal with the sites or the forces necessary to cut off their movement out of the country. That's a very small, narrow example of not marrying objectives and means. How are we doing on something like Iran right now? Do you think that we're marrying our objectives and means well? What do you think?
Getting better.
Getting better.
Talking.
Talking. Okay. Is that a consensus view? We're getting better?
No.
All right, so let's take a closer look. What are the objectives? What's the essential objective? The essential objective is to prevent Iran from going nuclear. Now, right now, we have succeeded in isolating Iraq, at least before the international community. So that's a good example of statecraft, insofar as what we have is a couple of resolutions at the Security Council. Those resolutions make it clear that the rest of the world shares the objective of preventing Iran from going nuclear. And in a sense, we have succeeded in isolating the Iranians. So that's good. But a lot of people here are saying, not such a good marriage of objectives and means, right? Well, the reason you might say that is because today we have slow motion diplomacy at the Security Council, highly incremental. Every 60 days we can go back and revisit the idea of new sanctions. But we have fast-paced nuclear development on the Iranian side. So right now our means don't fit the objective. Is it impossible to marry the two? I don't think so. But to do that, you have to make realistic assessments. What was our problem in Iraq? We had faith-based assessments. We didn't have reality-based assessments. In Iraq, if we had had reality-based assessments, might we have understood that we were going to face an insurgency? Might we have understood that there could have been a sectarian conflict? Might we have understood how difficult the process would be? By the way, none of that necessarily argues against having made the decision to go. But it does argue for having reality-based assessments, not faith-based assessments. A reality-based assessment today of Iran might well suggest where the points of vulnerability on the Iranians lies and where our points of leverage lie. And this brings me to another essential point about statecraft. It's not just about marrying objectives and means. It's not just about having reality-based assessments. It's about understanding leverage. I said this book originally, when I was going to write it, was going to be about negotiations and mediation. And there's four chapters in the book about negotiation and mediation as tools of statecraft. You can't succeed in a negotiation if you don't have leverage. By the way, you can't succeed in a negotiation if you don't know what your objectives are. You can't succeed in a negotiation if you don't understand who you're dealing with, meaning have a realistic assessment. You can't succeed in a negotiation if you don't understand the importance of timing. I say in the book that timing is to statecraft what location is to real estate. So let's take a look at the Iranians. With a realistic assessment, do we have the potential for leverage? I would say yes. This is a country that has enormous vulnerabilities. It has an economy that isn't working, even though it's had the last 4 years of high oil prices. The price of oil in March 2003 was $27 a barrel. So it's $40 higher a barrel right now. Even though they've had a windfall, in a sense that they didn't deserve, they didn't earn, their economy is still plagued by very high inflation, very high unemployment. They have to import 40% of their gasoline because they can't refine enough on their own. Their stock market is plummeting. Their oil output and natural gas output is declining, because their infrastructure requires massive investment from the outside, technology transfer from the outside. And we've seen even the limited application of sanctions has produced a public debate on the Iranian side. Public debate in the sense of the elite being engaged in a public debate. Now, that public debate shows that pressure and leverage exists. It shows the potential to change their behavior. But it hasn't yet changed their behavior, because what we've seen, as I said, is fast-paced nuclear development. So are we left only with military means to impress them? I don't think so. If there's a public debate on their side, which shows an opening, then what you have to do is you have to build up the economic pressure now. So what are the means? Again, you come back not just to marriage of objectives and means, you come back to focusing on what are your means for exercising leverage? And more importantly, how do you mobilize other means beyond your own, which is the essence of good statecraft? One of the reasons you have to communicate well is because you're mobilizing other means. One of the reasons you have to frame objectives clearly and in a way that is convincing to others is so that you can mobilize the means from others. Today, the Europeans still provide close to $20 billion a year in credit guarantees. They're applying pressure on the one hand, but obviously they're not cutting the Iranians off. The Saudis have enormous financial holdings in Europe. Do they want Iran to go nuclear? Another rhetorical question. They do not. They see an Iran with nuclear weapons as having a shield behind which they can engage in coercion and subversion. So they have a similar interest to ours. But if anyone has paid attention to Saudi behavior lately, they're not going to do something because we asked them. They're going to do something because it's in their interest. So the challenge, if you want to change the behavior of the Europeans to move from incremental sanctions to ratcheting up sanctions, so they cut off credits, so they cut off technology, then maybe a good example of statecraft would be for the United States now to focus less on providing additional arms to the Saudis, although I'm not arguing against that. That's not going to stop the Iranians from going nuclear. And maybe it's more taking advantage of the leverage they have on the Europeans. I would say there are three basic pathways for affecting the European behavior so that the Europeans now will put much more pressure economically on the Iranians. And I say this because I don't want to see military force used. I think the use of force, in the end, will be a disaster. But I know an Iran with nuclear weapons will also be a disaster. I know an Iran with nuclear weapons changes the world as we know it. The president says that Iran with nuclear weapons would be destabilizing. You think that's a good way to frame the issue? To convince others? How about saying an Iran with nuclear weapons means we're going to have a nuclear Middle East, because the Saudis know that they can't allow the Iranians to have that kind of leverage without a counterweight of their own. If Saudi Arabia goes nuclear, and they probably already have a deal with Pakistan, what do you think of the Egyptian position? You think Egypt's position will be, we're going to allow the Saudis to be the only Arab country with nuclear weapons? I spoke to a senior Egyptian official a couple of months ago who said, if Iran goes nuclear, it's the end of the NPT, the end of the nuclear nonproliferation regime. So Iran goes nuclear means we have a nuclear Middle East, which is far more dangerous than anything we've seen today. If Iran goes nuclear, it means the end of the NPT, at least listening to the Egyptians, which means rather than having 8 or 9 countries with nuclear weapons, we might have 20 or 30. The world as we know it becomes far more dangerous. We have many more countries with the potential to miscalculate, many more countries likely to be operating on a hair trigger. Is that the world that we want? Do you think that's the world that the Europeans want? I don't think so. One way to talk to the Europeans is to start putting it in that frame. Because they, looking at international institutions and international regimes, want to preserve them, not see them destroyed. But I would offer a couple of other suggestions as well. One, as I said, is organize with the Saudis an approach to the private sector in Europe. Go to the big banks. Go to the investment houses where the Saudis have big holdings, and have the Saudis, if they agree to do it, and they have their own reasons, as I said, not as a favor to us, go to the Saudis and have the Saudis say, you do business with them, you don't do business with us, or something like that. A second way to affect the European behavior is basically have the Israelis go quietly and say, you know, you think the use of force is worse than Iran, the use of force against Iran is worse than Iran with nuclear weapons. That suggests that you think in the end you can live with an Iran with nuclear weapons. We can't. Not because we don't necessarily want to, but because Iran says we can't, because they won't let us. This past week, what did Ahmadinejad say? He said there's a countdown to the destruction of Israel, only he didn't use the word Israel. He said there's a countdown to the destruction of the Zionist regime. Now, when someone keeps saying that, and he does keep saying it, I don't think you should just dismiss it. In any case, the Israelis won't. So a message from the Israelis to the Europeans was, we can't live with an Iran with nuclear weapons. The path you're on is going to produce it. If you don't want force to be used, don't put us in a position where that's our only choice. That's a second way to affect the Europeans. A third way. One of the things the Europeans believe is that the only way to resolve this conflict, crisis with Iran, is for the U.S. to negotiate directly with them. Now, the administration a year ago said they would negotiate if there was a suspension in enrichment. I can tell you the Europeans that I speak to, when I speak to senior Europeans, want the U.S. to negotiate because they believe the only way to solve this is if the Iranians also see that the U.S. is part of the deal, directly, not indirectly. And it's going to involve a range of different kinds of concerns that have to be addressed on the Iranian side, including the security dimension. Here again, leverage, the concept of leverage. If you want the Europeans to ratchet up the pressure now, make it clear. You know what? We are prepared to engage them directly. we can't simply dispense with the idea of the condition on suspension of nuclear uranium enrichment, because if we do that, we're going into negotiation. The message we're sending is we need Iran more than Iran needs us. Not the way to negotiate with anybody. But we're prepared to go, dropping that condition, if you will meet the terms now of ratcheting up dramatically the economic pressures, cutting off Iran from the international financial system. You want to concentrate the Iranian mind. So those within the Iranian leadership who want nuclear weapons, and they all do, but aren't prepared to pursue them at any price, get the picture. The only way that they can avoid a price they don't want to pay is by giving up or at least suspending them, deferring it. And then they begin to look for what they get. Maybe there are other things that can be done. Maybe there are other things that can be done that raise the pressure and leverage on the Revolutionary Guard, who are the main driving force for the weapons. I'm not trying to be exhaustive. I'm trying to suggest that using an approach where you think about statecraft, where you focus on where you have leverage, where you focus on the means of your own and others who have means that can be effective, you can change the reality. In the end, the reason I wrote this book is as much for the next administration as this one. I don't have high expectations that this administration is going to be able to change its behavior. Behavior, like sociology, is accumulated over time. How you make decisions, how you reach them, how you carry them out, not so easy in the seventh year of an administration to change that sociology. But I want the next administration to think in statecraft terms. I want the word to have meaning. I want it to be understood. I want it to be instinctual. After nearly 8 years of this administration, restoring this is going to be essential for restoring our position in the world. And I fervently hope that we can do that. Thank you.